From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the creator of the Caped Crusader of Gotham. Bob Kane drew Batman for DC Comics from 1939 to 1966. Also today, filmmaker John McNaughton tells us about his controversial horror film, Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. He describes it as too bloody for the art crowd, too arty for the blood crowd. Commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us about a group of rockers who don't know when to quit, and Mark Halliday is back with a poem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The pressure on Lithuania to rescind its declaration of independence continued today, with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev ordering foreign diplomats and journalists to leave the republic. Lithuania's parliament worked to form a new government, but its proceedings were interrupted by a helicopter dropping leaflets repeating Gorbachev's order for Lithuanians to disarm and disband a newly formed defense force. The BBC's Bridget Kendall reports from Vilnius.
Although the helicopter only briefly drowned proceedings in the parliament, it's nonetheless contributed to tension in Vilnius. Though outwardly calm, it's clear people are concerned about tomorrow's deadline for Lithuanian conscripts to return to Soviet military barracks and for the Lithuanian parliament to respond to the latest telegram from Moscow calling for preparations for a voluntary force in the republic to be disbanded. This morning, the Lithuanian leader, Professor Landsbergis, told the parliament that signs of Soviet military maneuvers in the republic and the recent instructions from Moscow amounted to psychological warfare, and he urged the parliament to sit through the night if necessary in order to have a new government in place by the end of tomorrow. So far, the world hasn't recognized us, he said, because we have no government. Now it will have to make its choice.
Bridget Kendall reporting from Lithuania. At the Iran-Contra trial of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter, the defense today called Republican Congressman Henry Hyde of Illinois to testify. Hyde, a conservative, was there to support Poindexter's position that there was no need to lie to Congress about aid to the Nicaraguan Contras in the mid-1980s because such aid was permissible for the National Security Council. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
Hyde testified forcefully that in his view the Boland Amendment banning all military and intelligence aid to the Nicaraguan Contras in the mid-1980s did not apply to the National Security Council. Cross-examined by prosecutor Dan Webb, Hyde acknowledged that a legal opinion prepared for him by a House Republican staff lawyer reached the opposite conclusion. I'm happy to say that staffer is not working as a lawyer anymore, said Hyde. He's been promoted, not by me. But Hyde's most scathing words were reserved for former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane, the man who preceded Admiral Poindexter as National Security Advisor. When Prosecutor Webb noted that McFarlane had testified that the Boland Amendment did apply to the National Security Council, Hyde responded, "Yes, that was the saddest testimony I've ever seen. It was sycophantic. He was stroking the fur of the committee chairman." I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
Former Exxon Valdez Captain Joseph Hazelwood was ordered today to pay $50,000 as restitution for his part in the nation's worst oil spill. Alaska Superior Court Judge Carl Johnstone imposed the penalty when he sentenced Hazelwood in Anchorage. Johnstone sentenced Hazelwood to a maximum of 90 days in jail and fined him $1,000, but he then suspended the jail term if Hazelwood spends 1,000 hours helping to clean up the oil left on the beaches of Prince William Sound. This is NPR. U.S. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh said today that U.S. cocaine users are partly to blame for drug-related violence in Colombia. Thornburgh, speaking in California, linked the appetite for drugs in the U.S. to yesterday's assassination of Colombian presidential candidate Bernardo Jaramillo. The Colombian government of President Virgilio Barco has accused the Medellin drug cartel of hiring a gunman to kill Jaramillo in Bogota's international airport. Media reports in Colombia say police have killed the son of Bolivia's so-called king of cocaine. The son of Roberto Suarez Gomez was killed today in a firefight with police who went looking for him after an attack on the home of a U.S. drug agent. Roberto Suarez Gomez, the father, is serving a 12-year prison sentence for cocaine trafficking. Two Michigan mothers were sentenced to up to 40 years in prison today for lining up their children and letting men choose among them for sex. Cindy Hosbein of member station WGVU in Grand Rapids has more.
Carolyn Wilson and Annette Sanford each received 5 to 15 years for third-degree criminal sexual conduct, while Wilson got 20 to 40 years and Sanford 10 to 40 years for first-degree criminal sexual conduct. The convictions pertain to the sexual abuse of Wilson's now 13-year-old son and 15-year-old daughter, who testified their mother and Sanford forced them, their sister, and Sanford's three young daughters to line up several times a week so that visiting men could select one for sex. The children said the molestations occurred probably hundreds of times between 1985 and 1988. While the two families lived together in Plainwell, authorities believe either drugs or money changed hands. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Hosbein in Grand Rapids.
On Wall Street today, prices closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up nearly 9 points at 2704.28. Advances led declines 8 to 5 in light trading of 132 million shares. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Batman, Robin.
That's right. We're after some jewel thieves, but our car's been disabled. May we use yours?
Sure, hop in.
No, I meant we'll take yours and you stay here with ours. There might be trouble.
Well, trouble don't bother me none. But if that's the way you feel about it, take her and welcome.
Pretty wooden for superheroes, huh? Apparently one of Batman's special gifts is the ability to survive even the clunkiest portrayal, like that 1949 movie serial. Batman triumphed last summer in the movie that became the highest-grossing film of all time. My guest, Bob Kane, is the creator of Batman. Over the years, he's watched the Cape Crusaders' continuing adventures with alternate pride and horror. Kane created Batman in 1939 and continued drawing him for DC Comics until 1966, the year the Batman TV series debuted. When he gave up drawing Batman comics, Kane started painting Batman on canvas. He's also written several TV screenplays and created a few new characters. Kane has written a new autobiography. It's called Batman and Me. Kane created Batman a year after the debut of Superman comics. The idea of creating a new superhero was initiated by Kane's editor at DC Comics.
Well, I was having lunch with the editor that time, Vincent Sullivan, and he said he was looking for another superhero. Actually, Superman was created in 1938, and the period when I spoke to Vincent Sullivan was 1939. It was about a year later. And prior to that, I was doing fill-in cartoons for DC Comics and making maybe $20, $25 a week. And I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, Siegel and Shuster. He said they were making $800 a week apiece. Now, in 1938, that was comparable to about $5,000 a week today. And I was kind of a poor kid from the Bronx looking to, you know, get wealthy and famous. So I said, hey, for that kind of money, I could create a superhero. So I went home that weekend, and I drew upon some of my early influences. And as I recalled, I was 18 at the time, but when I was 13 years old, I saw a book by Leonardo da Vinci, a book of inventions. And he had one book with a flying machine, an ornithopter, and it was a man on a sled with huge bat wings. And even Leonardo had a quote on that particular invention. It was the first man in flight, the first glider, actually. And the quote was, your bird shall have no other model but that of a bat. And it kind of initiated an idea to me about a Batman. And that was when I was 13 years old. So that weekend, I drew upon that influence. And there were movies I used to be influenced by as a kid, one called The Mark of Zorro, The Dual Identity with Douglas Fairbanks Sr. And that gave me my second influence. During the day, he was a board count in the Southern California in the 1880s. And at night, he became a crusader fighting against the injustices of the dictatorship at that time. And so that was my second influence for the dual identity. And then there was a movie called The Bat. And The Bat was a villain, but he wore a bat costume, and I guess that influenced me for a bat costume also. So they were my three major influences.
Why did you make Batman someone without superpowers? I mean, he was a regular mortal who was very, very fit and very clever, but he didn't really have superpowers like Superman did.
Exactly. For one thing, I didn't want to emulate Superman and imitate it because I thought maybe they wouldn't want that. and I wanted to come up with something original, for one thing. And secondly, I felt that every person that doesn't have superpowers could relate to Batman a lot easier than they could to Superman. In other words, you didn't have to come from another planet to be a superhero. All you had to do was be born rich and build your body into perfection and have the urge to go out and fight crime. So most people like the idea that Batman never had superpowers. They can relate to him a lot quicker than to a superhero with superpowers.
Now, you said that his look, Batman's look, was inspired in part by the Zorro movie that you liked so much. Now, you were, when you were young, in a gang called the Crusading Zorros, and you used to wear hooded masks. What was the connection between the Crusading Zorros that you were a member of as a kid in the Bronx and the Batman look?
Well, to begin with, we wore the Zorro wore a mask at night to hide his identity. So that the desperados that he would apprehend would know him during the day if they saw him. Therefore, they couldn't retaliate. And when I was a kid and living in the Bronx, we had these clubs, that we would all band together to protect ourselves against rival gangs in other neighborhoods. It was pretty tough in the Bronx at that time. And so we wore Zorro masks to hide our identities when we would raid one of the rivals' clubs and kind of beat up on them. And therefore, if they wanted to retaliate, Terry, they wouldn't know who to apprehend because we wore the masks of Zorro. It was a dual identity, so to speak.
You tell a terrific story in your book, Batman and Me, about how when you were young and in this gang, the Crusading Zorros, that you know, you weren't wearing your costume this day, and you were being pursued by a rival gang called the Vultures.
Yeah.
And at one point, before they really beat the heck out of you, at one point you thought that you had overcome them. What was the feeling like then? And I'm wondering if you felt like a superhero for that brief moment when you thought you had outwitted them.
Yeah, well, you see, we were very impressionable, and I was particularly because of my creative mind. And I always related to my influences. Like when I saw James Cagney in The Public Enemy, I thought I was James Cagney. And a famous scene in The Public Enemy occurred when James Cagney thrust a grapefruit into his girlfriend's face because she annoyed him. So I tried out on one of my girlfriends when I was very young, and I pushed a grapefruit in her face one night, and she quickly retaliated by hitting me over the head with a chair, and that cured my penchant for grapefruits and hitting girls in the face with a grapefruit. But at any rate, getting back to your earlier question, which eludes me at the moment, what was that again?
Oh, about if when you had briefly eluded the Vultures, if you felt like a superhero.
Exactly. So when I was caught by this Vulture gang, I was heading toward my neighborhood, and we had a lumber yard that we used to play out in with a lot of nooks and crannies, and I knew it very well. And somehow that early evening, none of my gang members were around and to join me in the fight. And so I jumped over the fence and kind of hid in some of the nooks and crannies until they caught up with me. But then I remembered Zorro's daring do deeds of jumping around when he fought the desperados in the Spanish West. And so I started to climb shafts of lumber. And when I arrived on the highest part of the lumber yard, the highest shafts, I felt like I was King Kong atop the Empire State Building. And I started thrusting these shafts of lumber down on the Vultures who were below in the lumber yard. And then I started swinging around on the pulleys, and I really felt for a moment victorious because I had the advantage for quite a while because I knew the lumber yard and they didn't. But then I fell off one of the shafts of lumber, cascaded down around me when I landed on it, and I fell to the ground. And that's when they all attacked me. There were about six of them, and they really beat up on me pretty badly. They broke my arm and a couple of my front teeth. And then they crushed my knuckles, my right hand, the drawing hand. And actually, this injury inadvertently kept me out of the service in World War II, although I enlisted in the Navy after Pearl Harbor. But I have kind of partial use of my drawing hand, and I have two porcelain jackets that remind me of that ominous stay in the lumberyard when I was a young and reckless boy growing up in the Bronx.
Now,
I really lived a real-life adventure, sort of like the ones I draw today in Batman.
Bob Kane is my guest, and he's written an autobiography called Batman and Me, which includes a lot of excerpts from Batman comics over the years. He originated the comic in 1939. Now, here you were, a Jewish kid growing up in the Bronx, right? Your superhero is named Bruce Wayne. I mean, what a very not Jewish name.
Well, it's an alliteration of Bob Kane.
Oh, okay.
Bruce Wayne.
Well,
alliteration. I wanted it to sound... I wanted to be Bruce Wayne in my reverie and
uh-huh.
in my daydreams. I felt instead of a poor kid, I imagined I'd like to be a rich playboy and fight crime at night because I hate all injustices in the world.
Would it have been possible to have made a Jewish superhero, or was that out of the question at the time?
Well, only for the Jewish Forward, which is a newspaper in the Bronx. But that's the only paper that would take a Jewish hero.
Tell me why you decided to draw Batman in tights and shorts. Now, I know Superman was drawn that way.
Well, actually, it's called the Union Suit character. And for whatever reason, Superman started it, and it seemed to work. And mine was second, except I used a bat cape and the bat symbols, the bat mystique, which spread out into the bat cave, the batmobile, the batarang, and so forth. I used the entire bat mystique to create my bat world. Superman only had a telephone booth. So mine is really more merchandisable, so to speak, and also more mysterioso. Yeah. Somehow you enhance an idea. You begin with it. It's just a germ of an idea. And as I studied the history of comics in America, all the comics heroes were very crude at the beginning, and they developed along the way. Like Dick Tracy didn't have a two-way wristwatch when he started. That came along later.
You started off doing slapstick comics and then turned to Batman. How did your drawing style change to create the Batman mood?
Well, I was a very good copyist, Terry, and I was able to copy superheroes at an early age. At 15, I could copy Flash Gordon almost as well as the artist who drew him, Alex Raymond. And I used to dabble in copying all the comics, slapstick as well as the illustrative kind. And the reason for my adaptation and switching over to the illustrative art rather than slapstick art was simply because there was more money in the superhero. Like when I asked Vincent Sullivan how much money the Superman artists were making, they were making $1,600 between them during any given week, and I was making $25. So I did that because of the money, basically. Intrinsically, I really would rather draw slapstick comics. I've always been a great lover of the early Mutt and Jeff and Popeye and Maggie and Chigs, and those were the comics that I grew up on that I wanted to emulate and become a slapstick comic artist, but I realized that the illustrative superhero was probably my forte for making money and fame.
Batman was obviously inspired by the success of Superman. What was the reaction initially of the Superman artists to Batman? Did they think that you were just stealing from them?
No, not really, because Batman really was nothing like Superman in costume or in the general genre. Superman came from a Krypton, another planet, and he had superpowers. He could fly and leap great heights over buildings, where Batman was merely a mortal that wore a bat costume. And no, they weren't surprised, because they knew that there would be a whole slew of imitative superheroes to come, and mine was second. And frankly, Terry, after Batman and Superman, there really wasn't another original superhero in the last 50 years. All they are offshoots, in one way or another, of the costumes, of new costumes based on Superman and Batman. Few of them don't have superpowers like Bruce Wayne, Batman. Most of them do have superpowers, but nobody other than Spider-Man which came along about 25 years later, and it's kind of a unique character, and it looks like a spider. It's amazing, though, how all the characters other than Superman took on the names of insects, animals, and so forth, if you want to analyze it.
Did you ever see a bat when you were growing up?
Well, I had great fears of bats, and therein lies an amazing dichotomy also. The fact that who thought any character with a name like a Batman would go, only because even my publisher at that time thought it was a very ominous name, and he suggested I change it. And I said, well, why don't we try one issue, and we'll see how it goes. But when the issue sold out, and I came to him, and I said, well, what about changing the name? Let's call him Irving Schwartz the Tailor, or whatever. He laughed, and he said, no, let's keep the name, because, you know, obviously the bottom line in any industry, in motion pictures and comic books, is money. If you're making money, you stay with it.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about Batman. And my guest is Bob Kane, who created Batman Comics in 1939, and he continued drawing Batman for DC Comics until 1966. He's written a new autobiography called Batman and Me. This is Fresh Air.
To the Batmobile. Let's go.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Bob Kane is my guest, the creator of Batman. You drew Batman for DC Comics. You stayed with that house. What are some of the pros and cons of doing a comic for a comic book house like that? Who owns the rights to the characters, for instance?
Unfortunately, that's that's part of the negative part of the business, is that when you're young, you sell away your copyrights, and actually that happens with most of the cartoonists, and they owned the character at that time, I couldn't take it elsewhere. And actually, I was making very good money, and in 1940-41, I was making practically $1,000 a week, and so you're not about to leave. And $1,000 a week in 1940 was comparable to about $5,000-$6,000 today a week. And so, being that they owned the copyright, I did the best I could at the time by compromising and getting a good piece of the action and a perpetuity contract. So therefore, I did rather well compared to some artists who sold it away and didn't get very much out of it.
Have you owned a piece of the merchandising over the years?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do rather well.
I'll bet, yeah.
I mean, all things being equal, I'd love to own it, and I would have done 1,000% better, but I didn't do badly the way it turned out, and life is a compromise. If it weren't for the publisher, I never would have been where I am today. So, you know, one hand washes the other.
How did the comic book code affect you in 1954? And the code restricted content matter of the comics. And this was a period
See, for a while, what happened was, whenever there's a successful industry, you generally have some sleazy fly-by-nights that want to cash in on it and on the coattails of anything famous. And so a bunch of these fly-by-night publishers came out with some really schlocky, if I could use that word, books that depicted sex that we never had, blatant sex, you might say, violence, cutting heads off with the blood oozing out, and they had bad grammar and illicit wordage and so forth. And so the whole industry suffered along the way with its sleazy books, because a lot of mothers stopped their children from reading comic books in general, including the DC line and other books of our good caliber. So what happened is a code was set up, like in the early days of the motion picture industry, they had the Hays office, which was a code of ethics of what you could do or what you could show or not show on the screen. If there was too much sex and violence, they cut down on that. I think a censorship is good to a degree, But if you have too much censorship, you take away the freedom of the press and the writer and the artist and so forth.
Were your freedoms restricted? Were there things that you wanted to do and couldn't do when the code was put into practice?
Oh, no. No, our books were never... We censored our own books, so we weren't under the fire of the of the anti-comic book people and the parents' associations and so forth. No, our books were always clean, so we had nothing to worry about. We just had to sit tight, and then we had a code which the good comic book publishers created, and which had to have every drawing had to have a stamp of approval by the Comics Code of America, and then this knocked out the sleazy comic books only because they couldn't get the code of approval, therefore they couldn't get any distribution, so they stopped publishing, and they only interfered maybe a year or two, and then they all died out, and we went on our merry way publishing clean comic books as they are and have been all through the years.
There are still Batman comics now, yes?
Oh, sure. I mean, we have ghost artists. In fact, the new breed of Batman comics are graphic novels, and they're done with hardcovers. Some of them are $30 a book. Some are $25 a book, and they're done on beautiful paper. There's been a whole evolution since the days I created Batman for 10 cents a comic book. Now, Batman number one that I don't own, the 39 book, the May issue of Detective Comics, has started in 6 pages, now sells for $50,000. There are only about 12 in the country, and I don't have one of them. I had them 1 to 100, but my first wife threw them all out when I got divorced. But anyway, one day I'll get number one back, I guess.
Just briefly, can you tell us what you thought of the movie Batman? You were a consultant to that.
Yes, I was project consultant, and I did add a lot of my input. I drew the costumes. And I said the costume has to be rigged with wire that when he jumps through a skylight, it'll billow out behind him like a bat. And I critiqued the script and so forth. I thought it was very true to the roots of Batman, the way I started it, whence it came. In other words, Batman had gone back to the Mysterioso, dark, brooding Batman that I created in the early years. I love the campy version, but I really prefer the dark, brooding version. And I think the sets were marvelous. The whole mood of the movie had a different film noir look. And look, it grossed over $250 million. It's one of the all-time top grosses in Hollywood from the time of its inception. And in Europe, it'll probably make another $200 million. And plus the merchandising and the video cassettes, the Batman could very well go to $1 billion. That's more than any movie ever earned or ever will earn in the history of movies. And I love the movie. I thought it just was true to my original dark brooding. I was just worried it shouldn't turn into a campy TV show again, and it did not. It followed faithfully my early... mood of the genre of Batman.
Well, Bob Kane, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it. God bless, and we'll see you in the movies of Batman 2.
All right.
Okay.
Bob Kane is the creator of Batman, and he's written a new autobiography called Batman and Me. It's published by Eclipse Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, is a low-budget horror film. When it was screened at the Telluride Film Festival, some people left in disgust, but some of those who stuck around called the movie brilliant. Now it's coming to movie theaters, unrated. Coming up, we meet the film director, John McNaughton. Also, commentator Maureen Carrigan tells us about a group of overaged but not over-the-hill rockers. They're the group Sucker. And we hear a poem from Mark Halliday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. U.S. diplomats in Lithuania have been ordered out of the country by the Soviet Union and will leave within a 12-hour time limit. Bush administration officials say that diplomats from other countries have also been told to leave, along with some reporters. President Bush today warned the Soviet Union that any effort to use force against Lithuania is bound to backfire. The president combined his statement with a declaration that the U.S. stands with the people of Lithuania and supports their right to self-determination. A commission has been set up in the Transylvania town of Turgu Mureș to investigate the cause of this week's violence. 9 people were killed and several hundred others injured. Sally Eckroyd of the BBC reports.
It's been a heated meeting in the heavily guarded town hall as the commission tries to hammer out who was to blame for this week's bloody clashes and what should be done in future. The local council executive today voted to resign en masse and elect new leaders to try to restore confidence. The suggestion now is that Hungarians and Romanians would be represented equally, each team appointed by the other side. Deep-rooted hostilities between the two communities are now focusing on Hungarian demands for their own schools. The Romanian education minister, who's part of the delegation, said that would be acceptable to his government as long as the schools followed the national curriculum. Târgu Mureș itself, meanwhile, remains outwardly calm today.
Sally Eckroyd of the BBC. El Salvador's ambassador to the United States said today that his government is ready to begin talks to end the 10-year civil war in his country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Both the Salvadoran government and the FMLN rebels are sending signals that they will soon start negotiations under the supervision of United Nations Secretary General Javier Pérez Cuellar. Last December, the 5 Central American presidents asked Pérez Cuellar to bring the two sides together. Today, Salvadoran Ambassador Miguel Salavarria expressed optimism that talks could start soon.
In the last 2 days, the government has announced its willingness to reinitiate dialogue with the FMLN without preconditions. It has done so because of new sentiments expressed by the guerrilla that they will cease attacks on innocent civilians and government officials.
Salavarria says an agreement on the date and location of the talks could be announced soon. There was no official word from the FMLN rebels. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 9 points to close at 2,704.28 on volume of 132 million shares. Trading was light as declining issues edged out advances 8-5. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Youth and passion go together. Things that obsessed us when we were in our teens sometimes slip away as we grow older. Commentator Maureen Carrigan says we may let go of some things too easily. She recently found a group of 4 guys who have been sharing a rock and roll ritual ever since high school.
It's Saturday night in a suburb outside Lancaster, Pennsylvania. David McCormick's parents are away for the weekend. That means he and the 3 other guys in the band Sucker have the house all to themselves. The basement's filled with amplifiers, cigarette smoke, and beer cans. They've almost killed off the case they bought last night. It's okay. They're overage. Though you might not know it by how they introduce themselves.
Nigel Goodeye drums. A.K.A. David McCormick.
And I'm James V., A.K.A. Wardell Sanders, and I play guitar and bass.
Ed Kaiser, A.K.A. Watt Sellers, guitar and bass.
And I'm Tim Frew, A.K.A. Virgil Tenor. And I play guitar, bass, and sing.
Most guys give up their phony British stage names and their bands at around the same time they realize that rock and roll won't pay the rent. But the guys in Sucker have this much in common with The Who and The Stones. They just don't want to quit. Sure, they all have day jobs. David is an editor at The New Yorker, and Ward's a law student in Philadelphia who just made law review. Ed works in the labor movement in Washington, D.C., and Tim's a writer in New York. But they still try to get together every couple of months to rehearse, play some benefits, and keep alive their personae as Nigel, James V., Watt, and Virgil. Most people would say this is silly stuff for almost 30-year-olds. But then, most people who get up and go to work every day don't have enough rock and roll in their lives anymore. I know I don't. That's why I went to Lancaster to hear Sucker. After listening to them for a few hours, I no longer wondered why these guys still play rock and roll. I wondered why anyone would ever want to stop.
Things seem to be going really bad in your life. You know, you get missing deadlines, and you know, you get stuck on the subway, and you're bored. You never do anything, but you know, you have a Sucker weekend coming up, and that's what you think about, and that's what you look forward to.
The room's chilly. The amps are turned way too loud. Their vocals are kind of rough, and they've offered me nothing to eat since I got there but beer. I feel great. For the past few years, I've been mostly listening to those museum pieces on classic rock radio or the occasional new album. I'd forgotten the energy and the sense of possibility that live rock and roll generates. Over the years, the band members have had their brushes with fame, a gig at CBGB's, a recording contract with a company that went broke. But they really aren't in the rock marketplace. Sucker is an active metaphor for a way of living. The music provides community, consolation, and transcendence, everything but money and stardom.
I guess our bass inspiration is sort of like heavy metal groups in the 70s, amateurism, you know, and... Just sort of doing it for the fun of it was a value. I'm not sure if that's true today or anything, but that's sort of how we got started, and I guess we're sort of true to that now, at least the amateurism part.
But how long can Sucker keep going? Does there come a time when playing rock and roll, or even liking it, is inappropriate? A few years ago, I was teaching Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl to some college freshmen, and I mentioned that Ginsberg was featured on The Clash's new album. Suddenly, I was getting the kinds of looks I've given to old folks at weddings who think they're getting down when they dance to a Three Dog Night medley. How do you know about The Clash? One kid asked me. I thought about the record I'd been bopping around to in my living room the night before. I could have told him I'd read about them in the Arts and Leisure section of the New York Times, but then I looked him straight in the eye. Old people can listen to rock and roll too, you know. He looked at me pitifully. What I like about Sucker is that they're not about to be embarrassed out of their love for rock and roll just because they're getting a little long in the tooth. So what if older rockers are better off heard than seen? Have you caught a glimpse of Keith Richards in that beer commercial? Sucker will just find some place to play where the lights are very low.
I always think of those old farts playing, you know, like, you know, Holiday Inns and stuff like that, and they, you know, balding, and their audience is mid-30s or something like that, and they sound pretty good. You know, they don't sound particularly inspired or anything, but they sound pretty good. Maybe as we get older and we'll keep doing this, we'll get better. And
we're going to end up at the Hilton?
I don't know what I'm saying. I guess I'm saying, you know, we'll get better, and technically we'll be able to get away with just about anything we want, so we won't have to worry about being old or anything. People, you know, just hear the music and like it. And maybe we will end up playing Holiday
Inns. The notion of playing some of these songs when we're 50 years old is kind of a scary thought.
He's talking 50. I'm an old cow, I am. I'm a real crank. And I come to town just to hear the band. I know all the songs and the cowboys know about the big corral where the dogs go. I learned them all on the radio.
Sucker is scheduled to appear in New York City and Washington, D.C. this summer. Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University and currently listens to Bruce Springsteen, Till Tuesday, and Sucker. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
After years of being held up in distribution, a controversial low-budget horror film is coming to theaters. Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, is loosely based on the true story of Henry Lee Lucas, who confessed to killing 360 people, including his mother. The movie was directed, co-written, and co-produced by my guest John McNaughton. It stars Michael Rooker as Henry. Film critic Elliot Stein caught one of its few midnight screenings. Henry headed Stein's 1989 10 Best list in The Village Voice. Stein wrote, "This truly disturbing little movie is a world apart from slasher fare. I really had it with serial killers on and off screen, but McNaughton seems the most talented independent filmmaker to come down the road since Gus Van Sant, the director of Drugstore Cowboy."
If you shoot somebody in the head with a .45 every time you kill somebody, it becomes like your fingerprints, see? But if you strangle one and stab another, and when you cut up, when you don't, then the police don't know what to do. They think you're four different people. What they really are, what makes their job so much easier, is a pattern. What they call a modus operandi.
I think one of the things that makes Henry so disturbing is that there's absolutely no normal point of view in it. Every character is really deeply disturbed.
Yeah, to me, you know, the idea with normally in a film, you're looking for a sympathetic character that you can sort of latch onto, and then you identify with this person, and then you can sort of cruise through the film having someone to identify with. One of the sort of tricks we played on the audience in this film is little by little, you're waiting for the sympathetic character to show, and little by little, you realize it's Henry. And at that point, you're forced to sort of sympathize with Henry, which is uncomfortable, I believe, because you have to find within yourself perhaps some of what is in Henry.
You know, it's easy to see Henry's emotional detachment as wounded sensitivity. So, you know, that instead of seeing that detachment as a sociopathic lack of feeling.
Yeah, I think that comes largely through Michael's performance. He chose to play it that way, and it really worked for us, and it made you feel something for him, which is, I think, one of the reasons the piece really works.
Now, if I have the story straight, you were commissioned to do a movie, a horror film, by Waleed Ali, who's the president of MPI.
Right.
This is the company, I think, that distributed Faces of Death, the alleged snuff films?
Yeah, they're not snuff films. They're pretty vile. But unfortunately for Waleed's company, that's the thing that they've gotten the most publicity for. He also handles the film Beckett. They own that for, you know, which is a very classy piece. And the Beatles pictures. They have everything from, you know, A to Z. And yeah, Waleed is the guy that gave me the money to make the movie, but the legend has grown up that you know, they do snuff movies, they do Faces of Death, and Faces of Death is, some of the stuff is actually staged, so But yeah, that's they do have that, and they've sort of been branded for it.
Now, what did they ask you to do when they gave you the money?
Well, Waleed and I had known each other for a long time, and Malik, who's his brother and partner, and, you know, we sort of had this dream years ago when they were getting started in the video business and they were working out of their parents' basement. We had this dream to make a movie someday, and for people that are in the business of video distribution, especially then in 1985 when the picture was made, it was a very, you know, it was a pretty sure bet that if you had a low-budget horror film and a good package, you could do okay with it in the marketplace. You know, the one thing Waleed has always given me in the projects we've worked on was total creative freedom, which I can't get anywhere else. And so he gave us the money and said, make a horror film, and I'll see you later. I'll come back when it's done.
Now, the way the story goes, I think, is that you, after making this deal, put on 2020 and saw a feature on Henry Lee Lucas, the serial killer that your movie's based on. What was it about that feature? What was it about Henry Lee Lucas that interested you?
Well, let me just say that to back up a little bit, that is the story you just told is the way it happened. And after Waleed, I was in Waleed's office on another matter. We were doing some other documentary project and something, there was a snafu and Waleed decided he didn't want to proceed with that project. So right during that meeting, it was like, Waleed said, hey, let's do that movie we've always talked about. And it was like, you know, it came from totally out of the blue, left field, whatever. It just sort of stunned me when he said it. And I walked into the office where this friend of mine, Gus, was working, and he showed me, you know, I said, Gus, Waleed has given me the money, the go-ahead to make a film, a horror film. I you know, I don't even know what I'm going to make it on yet. And he said, well, here, look at this. And he put in that cassette, and it was the 2020 segment on Henry Lee Lucas. And also the fact that when I saw this, again, here comes this guy on screen, this man, and he's like starts talking and stuff, and he's very sort of low-key, and he sort of takes you in, you know? He can win your confidence. And to me, and then they started telling his story of what he'd done, and to me, it's like, you want horror? This is horror in the modern world.
Instead of monsters,
well,
sociopaths.
Right, but to Richard Fire and I, who I write with, we sort of came up with the concept of something we call modern monsters. There are real monsters walking the face of the earth. Why? What do we need with guys with chainsaws and leather masks and hockey masks and monsters from outer space? We've got our, you know, we, to quote from my next movie, we home grow them right here.
Your movie was shown at a couple of film festivals, and from what I understand, the audiences were really divided. Some people really loved it and thought it was a very original piece of filmmaking. Other people were so offended by your treatment of the subject that they walked out. Were you flattered or upset by having people walk out of your movie?
It's sometimes hard for me to watch that picture with an audience, especially in a place, the place where the walkouts occurred was the Telluride Film Festival in Colorado. And you get a lot of people who are film buffs and art film buffs and stuff, and they've never really seen anything quite so strong. So the film was promoted pretty heavily by Errol Morris, who was the guest director at the festival, and he was the person responsible for getting the film shown. And I think a lot of the people, you know, were on Errol's recommendation, went to see this film expecting to see something very artistic, perhaps strong, but not as strong as what they encountered. So I don't feel, to see those people run leave the theater, I mean, I don't feel gratified to know that they feel deeply affected that they have to get out of the theater. But in another sense, it is a, you know, it does indicate the success of the strength of the picture.
Let me ask you about the rating for your movie. It initially was given an X rating. You're putting it into theaters unrated.
Right.
What were the reasons you were given by the MPAA for the X rating?
In the case of Henry, I think it's just so overall such a dark film that there were so many scenes that they basically told me that we can't tell you what to cut, Mr. McNaughton. It's just that you know. So many times they went into the example of the guy that gets it with the TV, and they said, Mr. McNaughton, what can I tell you? First, the guy, you know, Otis stabs him in the hand. Then Henry, Henry stabs him in the hand. Then Otis wraps a cord around his neck. Then Henry stabs him in the chest. Then they smash a TV over his head, and then they plug it in. She says, I can't tell you to cut any particular, you know, you have to, basically, you know, it was like cut everything. Just forget it, was what they said.
What are the advantages of putting it into theaters without a rating as opposed to with an X rating?
Well, X rating is the death blow to a motion picture, basically, to its commercial potential. Unrated isn't really a lot better, but the specifics of the situation is a lot of newspapers will not advertise X-rated films, and a lot of theaters won't show X-rated films. I don't think it's a bad idea that Henry should not be seen by people under 18. But I think once you are 18 and you're considered an adult, then you should be able to see what you please to see. And there have been great films in the past, such as one of my all-time favorites, Last Tango in Paris, and Midnight Cowboy, that were films of the 70s that went out with X ratings, but were seen by adults. You know, things have become more tightened up considerably since those days. And to get an X rating equates your film with pornography. I think many people agree, and probably quite a few people within the MPAA, that we should have a rating that's like 18A adult. That is not X-rated pornography. It's an adult picture dealing with adult themes that adults, should they choose to, can go and see it.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of theaters do you think will show your movie?
Well, mostly it's, you know, I mean, it's here in New York, it's being shown at the Angelicus, which is, you know, and probably the toniest cinema in the city of New York. It's going mostly into art houses in its initial run, and it's a strategy, you know, that the distributors, the Great Cat Films, and I think their plan is to first to get it out into more or less into the art houses so that it gets serious critical attention, and thereby building up backlog of serious critical attention, which then they can go out into the other markets.
Does Henry Lee Lucas know that you've made a movie about him?
I don't know. I would assume that sooner or later he will, but as of today, I don't know that he does.
If he found out and felt flattered, how would that make you feel?
I can't quite get into this question, and I don't quite know why, but it would seem to me that there are things about the film, I'll just sort of sidestep a little bit, say that there are things about the film that make me very uncomfortable, and, you know, I will not stand up and say what we did was 100% right, and that there is no way that it may create some bad influence in the world. I don't know, and if Henry were flattered by it, I don't understand what he would be flattered by, except that we chose a pretty good-looking guy to play him. I would tend to think that he would find, you know, since it's so, my opinion was, it would be that he would find it very inaccurate because it's not based 100% on fact by any means. It's largely certain incidents appear to be true from what we know of him, but a lot of it is made up. So I guess that doesn't answer your question, but I don't know. It's a question I can't really answer, I guess.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Filmmaker John McNaughton, he directed Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll hear about President Bush sounding a little bit tougher on Lithuania than he has in the past couple of weeks, as the Soviets have told foreign journalists and diplomats to leave the breakaway republic on the Baltic. We'll also be hearing about the debate between members of Congress and Defense Secretary Richard Cheney about defense spending and how much in the way of defense cuts is warranted by all the changes in Central Europe, and a talk with Ronnie McDowell, who does the singing for Elvis Presley in the TV show about Elvis.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Does coping with our bodies get any easier as we get older? Poet Mark Halliday ponders that question in this poem.
Being physical. You are always on the verge of blowing it, despite all your years of training. When you take a shower, for example, this time you might scald yourself, get suds in your eyes, lose your balance and tear the shower curtain, bump your skull on a soap rack or faucet. You might, and you know it intermittently, and intermittently you try to be constantly on guard. Millions of minute muscular maneuvers. You're such an old hand at these, it's incredible. But you're not getting any better. Ever since your 22nd birthday, roughly, your skills in most of life's jobs have been static, deadlocked, plateaued, apart from tiny little ups and tiny little downs, in your own clumsy version of mortal competence. Consider now the unpacking of groceries after shopping. How fast do you fold the emptied bags? In 30 years, you'll be no faster. How seldom do you misplace the ground beef or allow juice cans to bruise the tomatoes? 5 years ago, you were just as adroit. Perhaps you are not shocked by these allegations. There is no question of blame or shame in our thousand tiny daily jobbies, you say. Agreed. There is, though, pity. You, so infinite in faculties, in action you sometimes feel, so like an angel. What about the cigarette burn in the carpet? Explain the gouges in the cherry wood table. And the broken soup bowl, what about that? And while you're at it, tell us about the bent key. God, think of us being ordinary some 17 hours per day. Even professional basketball stars are not exempt. They nick themselves shaving and dent their Camaros doing nothing fancy. Just look how lodged we are in our world of missed wastebaskets, nickels dropped one more time in the pocket with the hole. Think of our brows furrowing grimly or in proud defiance. This time it's going to be right, incredibly quick, maximum efficiency. There is something sad about your concentration as you rinse those forks and knives for the 1500th time. You're no slouch tonight, eh? You're probably going to sprain your big toe next week, you poor physical veteran, protagonist, you buffoon, you.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Being Physical has appeared in the literary journal Boulevard. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews. Production assistants from Joan Tuohy, Allison Dufty, and Roberta Shurrock, who also directed today's show. Our station services director is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the guiding forces in American dance, choreographer Murray Lewis. And TV critic David Bianculli previews some network premieres. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.